We're about 2 months away from the spring holidays, and they're going to be here faster than we can even blink an eye, it seems. Time flies. So I want to ask you something. How are you doing? How do you feel about you? What's the condition of your moral compass? This is the time of year that each of us should be examining ourselves. Examining ourselves involves going through a thorough test to scrutinize by looking deep into ourselves. Paul wrote to the church at Corinth in 2 Corinthians 13, "Examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith." Are you truly in the faith? Test yourselves, he said. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you? And that's important because we couldn't make this journey without Jesus Christ being in us. We wouldn't know where we're going. This word examine is formed from a root in Greek that means to pierce. That means to really delve deep down inside, to look inside at who you are and are you truly following Christ. So how are you doing? Are you headed in the right direction? Today I want to talk about following Christ. The title of my sermon is Follow Me. It's a long, difficult road we have to face. And I talk about journey a lot because it's so important. It's the whole purpose. This journey is so important, but it's actually completing the journey that's most important. It's finishing. And so for some that have gone down this journey but have given up, it's just such a shame because they didn't complete. Now, they'll have a chance one day, but they're not here complete, doing the journey with us today. How many times did Jesus tell those who came to him, "Follow me"? "Follow me and I will make you fishers of men," he said. "Follow me and let the dead bury their own. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me." Follow me. It was so important. If you don't follow me, you're not going to get it. And notice he never did say it's an easy road. Follow me, it's going to be easy. He never said that. It was a difficult journey for the ancient Israelites. Even though they could see the pillar of fire at night and the cloud by day, they could see it. It was still a difficult journey for them. It was a difficult journey for the early Christians. The Apostle Paul, James, Stephen. It was a tough time. And it's a tough road for you and me. I want to talk to you today about looking at yourself, where your heart is, and judging your own spiritual well-being. Are you following Jesus Christ? Are you following God? No one can do this examination but you. I can't examine you. You can't examine me. You don't know what's in my heart. Only you know what's truly in your heart. That's why Paul said to examine yourself. But I want to begin by telling you a story. A story of a group of people that also had a difficult journey. The immigrants that first came to settle this country had a very difficult journey as well. If you take Interstate 10 down out of San Antonio, go west, through the little town of Burney, about 4 or 5 miles past Burney, you'll see a road sign on I-10 that says, Welfare, Texas. I call it a community because it's really not big enough to be called a town. Its post office closed in 1970, has a population of less than 40 people now. Yet it played an important role in the lives of some weary settlers in the mid-1800s. And their journey is how it got its name. I had the opportunity to visit Welfare, Texas several years ago. It's almost 20 years ago by now. My co-workers and I were hosting a conference in San Antonio, and for entertainment, we needed to show them Texas. And so we were able to arrange the Don Strange Ranch just outside of Welfare, Texas. Don Strange was known for many things, most notably his catering. He had a tremendous catering service. In fact, we were told he catered the inauguration for the senior President Bush. On his ranch, he would host events like weddings and corporate team buildings and just escapes, corporate escapes. And for our group, this was a perfect way to give people from other states a true glimpse of Texas, because we had people from all over the country coming to this event. The name Welfare was perfect because the conference we were planning was for employees of social service agencies. They were welfare workers, and so going to Welfare Texas just made sense. It was perfect. The ranch is also home for some of the retired Bevos, the UT Longhorn mascot. And so we got to look at these incredible beasts. They would come right up to the fence. It was incredible. It was truly a glimpse of Texas for these people. The ranch sits on 125 acres of beautiful hill country. It's just gorgeous. Don Strange himself died in 2009, but on the evening of our event, I had the opportunity to talk to him for a while. And he told me the story of Welfare Texas. Some of what I'm telling you is what Mr. Strange told me that night, and some I had to do a little research on my own just to fill in the blanks. Welfare, with many communities across Central Texas, has strong German roots. The Don Strange ranch itself was first settled by a German engineer and a builder by the name of Nicholas Zink. So this 125-acre ranch was built by Nicholas Zink back in the mid-1800s. In fact, the original house and barn built by Zink are still there, and they're preserved by the Texas Historic Society. Incredible, incredible, beautiful, rustic buildings sitting on this pristine 125 acres. Mr. Strange told me that Zink designed and built many structures across Central Texas. He built the grist mill in Green, Texas. He built the bridge that goes over the Guadalupe there in Green. I mean, he, just an incredible man. He had incredible vision. He settled the town of Sisterdale. So Central Texas was a dream for many German immigrants who were looking for a better life and opportunity. And Nicholas Zink played an important role in one group of these immigrants. Zink migrated to Texas in 1844. He was chosen to lead a group of German settlers to this place that had land for free. He was apparently selected because of that tremendous knowledge and experience that he had. He was gifted. He was a doer. Mr. Strange said that he built a skive. So this Nicholas Zink built a skive, which is this big rotating blade that would chop wheat. Anyway, big old blade, and he put it behind a horse or a mule or something, well, cut his leg off. So he said, so his leg is buried over there in that hill somewhere, and then he's buried in an unmarked grave somewhere else in the land. But he was just a doer. German immigrants continued to migrate to Texas and other parts of America because there was a lot of political unrest in Europe. The dream of a new life where there was plenty of land for the taking. It just was on their minds. Let's go to America. And Texas was a big attraction for many of these Germans. And you know that Central Texas and, well, all over Texas, we have these German communities. It was all freely given if you can just stay committed to the journey. If you can just do the journey, get here. Zink arrived in what is now New Braunfels in March 1845 and began plotting the parcels for this group of fellow immigrants. In fact, there is a Zink Street in New Braunfels named after him. And New Braunfels would become the central hub for these incoming settlers moving in to Central Texas. And as you can imagine, in the 1800s, that was a long and difficult journey coming from Europe. First, they had to travel by boat across this expansive Atlantic Ocean. And these boats were small and they were cramped. Living conditions were horrible. Diseases were easily spread on these boats, and many of the weaker travelers just didn't make it. They died on the trip. And those that survived continued forward because they had this vision of a better home. There's something better out there for us. And after months at sea, they finally arrived at the Texas coast. Present-day Galveston is where they would land. Some settled there and in Houston, but many more migrated to the Texas Hill Country and started their own settlements. Sisterdale. You've got settlements like New Braunfels, Fredericksburg, Kerrville, Burney, Comfort, all these German communities. They loaded up on the wagons what little belongings they could bring with them, or that had survived the long trip across the Atlantic if it survived it, and they headed for New Braunfels. Now, I've made that trip in a car many times, but I've never done it by horse or wagon or on foot. Southeast Texas is no picnic, especially when you're exposed to the elements. But these settlers had to deal with an added danger, the Comanche Indians. Mr. Strange told me that the hostilities between European settlers and the American Indians were very much alive in the mid-1800s, and many more of these settlers died at the hand of the Comanches. So you make the long trip, and you survive that trip across the Atlantic Ocean, and you get on a wagon headed for this beautiful place that you're going to call home, only to die at the hands of these Comanche Indians. It just seemed to be one trial after another. It just seemed to be, why are we doing this? I ask because, now, let me ask you, what would you have done? I mean, I ask because, you know, we criticize the ancient Israelites. We criticize them for their disbelief and their lack of faith, but what would you have done in their case? Would you have given up, turned around, and headed back to Germany? Well, finally, those that survived the boat trip and the land trip made it to New Braunfels. The remaining settlers made it to New Braunfels. One group of these settlers that made this long, weary trip finally got to New Braunfels and received yet another piece of devastating news. All the unimaginable difficulties, all the sacrifices, if it wasn't the boat trip and the unbearable conditions, it was the Central Texas heat or rattlesnakes and mountain lions, Comanche Indians. All of this they battled and survived only to be told, there's no more land. The land is gone. What do you do now? What do we do now? There's nowhere to go. All their struggles, their perseverance, their faith that something better truly did exist, just came to nothing. You and I are on our own journey to a better place. The spring holy days are our annual reminder of our responding to a call to make this journey to a better home. For many, it's been a long, wearisome journey. The Lesters come to mind. Many, some of you, it's been a long, wearisome journey. Many have given up. It's just too long. It's just too hard. I can't do it anymore. And we come to those points in our journey where we ask, where are we going now? Is there any place to go? It seems like we've come to a dead end. One trial after another. The ancient Israelites' journey through the wilderness is recorded in Scripture as an example for us to learn something from it. They were promised a better place. God called it a land flowing with milk and honey. And they came to their own New Braunfels, the Red Sea. What do we do now? Where do we go? What? We're brought here to die at the hands of the Egyptians. Why don't we just go back into Egypt? At least we could have died there with food in our stomachs. At least there was shelter there. How are you doing? How's your journey? Are you continuing to move away from your personal Egypt toward that promised land? A place you've never seen. It takes a great deal of endurance and patience and faith. Every one of these is important in our journey. Endurance. Christ spoke of enduring on many occasions, and one such is the parable of the sowers. You don't have to turn there. The seed that fell on stony ground. Matthew 13 and verse 20 says, but he who received the seed on stony places, this is he who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yay! Let's go! This is amazing! This is great! Yet he has no root, but endures only for a while. For when tribulation or persecution arises because of the world, immediately he stumbles. He gives up. I can't endure it. I can't do it. Patience. Luke 21 is the Olivet prophecy, companion to Matthew 24. I will ask you to turn there with me, if you will. Luke 21 and verse 16. Luke 21 and verse 16, Christ says, you will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends, and they will put some of you to death. And you will be hated by all for my name's sake. But not a hair of your head shall be lost. By your patience possess you your souls. The journey requires a great deal of patience. Your soul depends upon it. And then this faith, which of course, we go to Hebrews 11 when we talk about faith. Hebrews 11 and verse 13. Hebrews 11 and verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them. They embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. And you and I hold on to that same vision. What Abraham was seeking, we're seeking. We can see a glimpse of it. God has given us a foretaste through these annual holy days. We can see it. We can almost taste it. It's there. Verse 14, for those that, who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. They seek another home. This place isn't our home. We're just passing through. There's a better place, a place we can truly call home. Verse 15, and truly if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. There were many points in their journey that those German settlers must have thought, maybe we should just go back. Maybe this was a bad idea. Why didn't we just stay in Germany to die instead of here in this brutal place called Texas? It sounded so good on paper. There was a king of Israel that truly followed God. I mean, he was a tremendous example. In fact, he was called the greatest king that Israel ever had. That is until he made one fatal error. I mean, he followed God. He'll be in the kingdom, I have no doubt about that. But he made one fatal error. A king was Josiah. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king. When he took the throne. 8-year-old kid. Imagine adults following around an 8-year-old kid telling them, this is how we're going to run this country. But he was amazing. 2 Kings 22. Josiah was 8 years old, and orders. And then 2 Kings 22, Josiah orders the temple to be repaired. This is about 18 years later after he was anointed king. So he's about 26 years old. While rummaging through the debris, Hilkiah the high priest finds the book of the law. 2 Kings 22. In verse 11. Now it happened when the king heard the words of the book of the law, and I don't know how long this book of the law had been hiding there, but apparently because Judah had completely given up on God, it was just stuck there in the temple somewhere and under a bunch of rubble. When the king heard the words of the book of the law, that he tore his clothes. Then the king commanded Hilkiah the priest, Ahikam the son of Shaphan, Achbor the son of Micaiah, Shaphan the scribe, and Isaiah, a servant of the king, saying, go, inquire of the Lord for me, for the people, and for all Judah, concerning the words of this book that has been found. For great is the wrath of the Lord that is aroused against us, because our fathers have not obeyed the words of this book, to do according to all that is written concerning us. I mean, he had a bunch of zeal. He had a great deal of zeal. We didn't even know this existed, and God is really upset with us because of those that came before us have completely ignored everything. We didn't even know this was a requirement of us. Josiah was intent on following God. Follow me. I'm going to follow you, Father. And he sends his men to talk with the prophetess to ask, what should they do? This prophetess. And she tells them that God is going to deal with Judah. But because of Josiah's true desire to obey and follow God, the calamity won't happen while he is alive. It's going to happen. But I won't do it because of the humility and the tears that you wept when you found out, Josiah. 2 Kings 23 and verse 3. Then the king stood by a pillar and made a covenant before the Lord to follow the Lord, to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and all his soul, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in this book. And all the people took a stand for the covenant. He had everybody. Everybody was into it. And the king commanded Hilkiah the priest of the second order, and the doorkeepers to bring out the temple, out of the temple of the Lord, all the articles that were made for Baal, for Asherah, and for all the host of heaven. And he burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron and carried their ashes to Bethel. The rest of this chapter just tells how Josiah tore down everything that was built to serve other gods and burned them. Even went into Samaria, to the northern tribes, and everything that they had built to foreign gods, he tore down and burned. He had the greatest Passover that had ever been recorded. When they found out, through reading the book of the law, this is the way you follow God. And he executed the priests that worshiped these pagan gods and burned their bodies too. Drop down to verse 21. Then the king commanded all the people, saying, "Keep the Passover to the Lord your God as it is written in the book of the covenant." Such a Passover surely had never been held since the days of the judges who judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. No Passover had ever been observed like this. Even in the time of King David, nothing had happened like this Passover. To continue the story, turn with me to 2 Chronicles 35. Josiah had a heart. He had true zeal. He had a passion for God. He wanted to be just like God wanted him to be. He wanted to follow God. Assyria is beginning to decline, and the Babylonian Empire is making a rise, growing in strength and going to war against Assyria. Babylon is warring against Assyria. And Egypt has been an ally of Assyria for many, many years. King Necho of Egypt wants to keep Babylon from becoming so great that it might even threaten Egypt. So verse 20, 2 Chronicles 35. After all this, when Josiah had prepared the temple, Necho, king of Egypt, came up to fight against Carchemish, which is really Babylon, by the Euphrates. And Josiah went out against it. He sent messengers, so the king Necho sent messengers to him, saying, "What have I to do with you, king of Judah?" He said, "I have not come against you this day, but against the house with which I have war. For God commanded me to make haste." He says, "Refrain from meddling with God who is with me, lest he destroy you." Nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself so that he might fight with him, and did not heed the words of Necho from the mouth of God. So he came to fight in the valley of Megiddo. In order to get to the Babylonians, the Egyptian army must go through Judah. King Josiah said, "I'm not going to have this. Some foreign army is marching on my land? I'm not going to have this at all." Now, whether God actually told Necho to go to battle, it's not known, but it says, nevertheless, Josiah did not turn, he just dismissed what King Necho said. Verse 23, "And the archers shot King Josiah. And the king said to his servants, 'Take me away, for I am severely wounded.' His servants therefore took him out of that chariot and put him in the second chariot that he had, and they brought him to Jerusalem. So he died and was buried in one of the tombs of his fathers." So what did Josiah do wrong? You know, in every other instance, it looks, Josiah is going to God and asking God, "What do I do? I'm following God, and I can't follow God unless I'm talking to God. You can't follow God unless you're talking to God and reading His Word, as we heard in the sermonette. You can't follow God if you're not doing this, if you're not reaching out." I've done this. I've made terrible decisions when I did not go to God first, and I still suffer for some of those stupid decisions. We all do. This one was fatal for Josiah. Following God cannot be a part-time thing for us. We can't do it part-time. It has to be a full-time commitment. We have to be completely committed to it. Remember the rich young ruler who approached Jesus? He said, let's turn to Luke 18. Luke 18. Luke 18 and verse 18, "Now a certain ruler asked Jesus, saying, 'Good teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? What do I have to do to reach the promised land?' So Jesus said to him, 'Why do you call me good? I mean, no one is good but the one, that is, God. But you know the commandments: do not commit adultery, don't murder, do not steal, do not bear false witness, honor your father and your mother.' And he said, 'All these things I have kept from my youth. Been doing all these things.' It's the way I was raised. Verse 22, so when Jesus heard these things, he said to him, you still lack one thing. Sell all that you have and distribute it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. And come, follow me. Give it all up and follow me. But when he heard this, he became very sorrowful, for he was very rich. The young man just couldn't grasp that his money wasn't going to get him where he needed to be. Just give it up and follow me, Christ said. And that's what he's saying to each one of us. Give it up. What are you holding on to that you cannot give up for Christ's sake? There is a city that God is preparing for you and me. And our journey to that city can be very difficult at times. We've had to leave a world behind to pursue that same country the writer of Hebrews speaks of. Sometimes our vision becomes blurred because of obstacles that get in our way, that we allow to get in our way. There are certainly many dangers lurking about. We know that. In the end time, we're going to be the most hated people on earth. We all have family and friends who started on this journey but are no longer with us. And I'm not talking about organizations. I'm not talking about different organizations. I'm talking about people that just gave up on the vision. Said they believed in God at one time, and now they gave it up. An entire generation of ancient Israelites gave up on that vision. They just gave up. Throughout their journey in the wilderness, they never fully learned that following God will always lead to the promised land. It's just not always easy. It can be difficult. It requires endurance, patience, and faith. Spring holy days are our annual reminder that our journey is a lifelong process. And so we could go through so many examples of people who suffered through but made it. They made it because they just stuck with it. The Apostle Paul being stoned, shipwrecked, beaten, and still stuck with it. And guess where he came from? He was an enemy of God, and Jesus Christ said, follow me. Why are you torturing me? Follow me. What an incredible example. Follow me. You know, the spring holidays, being that annual reminder, they only last 7 days. That 7-day period is a symbol, though, of completeness. It's the total completeness of coming out of Egypt, of putting sin out of our lives and following God. And when the days of unleavened bread are over, our journey continues. Now, it's not done. It's just a symbol. We have to stay the course, allowing Jesus Christ to be our pillar of fire by night and our cloud by day. We can't see it, but we know he's there because he lives in us. And if he's living in us, let him lead you. You know, the word follow means accompany. Accompany me. Be a part of my group. It's not like a get behind me thing. It's a let's do this together. He's saying, let's do this together. Accompany me. Back to Hebrews 11. In verse 8. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out of the place which he would receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. You and I have been called to go and receive that same inheritance. The same thing that Abraham was seeking. We don't know every step of our journey or when we'll get there. We just know it's there if we stay the course. And I've said this before, it's not the journey that matters. It's the finish. It's getting to that place. The journey is important, but it's more important to finish that journey. Verse 9, by faith he, Abraham, dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him, of that same promise. He knew that the city God was preparing for him was still out there. And he knew he was a foreigner, even in the land God had provided him. He was still a foreigner. We too live in this world, but we are also pilgrims in this world. We can't plant our roots here. We just can't do it. We'll lose the vision. We'll lose the focus. This world has nothing to offer us. We're just passing through. Verse 10, for he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. This is the city that will last forever and ever and ever, and we can be a part of it for eternity, forever and ever. What are you seeking? Where is your moral compass taking you? Examine yourself. Are you on track? Or is something getting in your way? Watch the Beyond Today program last night, the most recent one Mr. Petty gave, and just we coveting. We want so many things. I want a bigger house, a better car. I want status. I want to be seen and heard. I want all these things that get in our way of being able to just say, it doesn't mean anything. We're just passing through. Drop down to verse 16. But now they, and we, desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for He has prepared a city for them and you. There's nothing to go back to. The temporary pleasures of this world cannot compare to what waits for us. Verse 24. By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. For he looked to the reward, kept the vision, kept the focus. All the physical rewards were there for Moses. Well, he could have everything. He was a prince. Yet he chose a long and difficult journey, the reproach and disgrace that would ensue, because he kept the vision. He kept looking forward. He was seeking that same home that Abraham was seeking. It's the same home that you and I are seeking. In its prime, the community of welfare had nearly 300 residents. But it didn't last. It too was temporary. Boll weevils destroyed almost all of the crop in the early 1900s, and many people just left. A severe drought was followed by a fire that burned down a great deal of the community. Hardly anyone goes there today. Few even know it exists. How many of you knew it, ever heard of Welfare, Texas? Yeah. Yet it was a welcome relief for some very weary travelers. Don Strange told me that Nicholas Zink heard about these German settlers that were told there was no more land in New Braunfels. He gathered some wagons of his own and went to New Braunfels. And when he got there, he told them, if you follow me, you will fare well. And that's how the Community Welfare Texas got its name. There is a home being prepared for you and me, if we stay the course with endurance and patience and faith. And this is that time of year for each of us to begin looking internally, piercing ourselves, judging ourselves, checking the direction we are headed, preparing ourselves for we'll never be worthy, but in the worthy attitude to approach the Passover, to observe the Passover, go into the days of unleavened bread, and recommit ourselves to God and Jesus Christ. Actually, we should be doing this every day of our lives. We should be looking at ourselves internally, not just for the 2-month period before Passover. Every day, we should be examining ourselves so that we can continue our journey of coming out of our own personal Egypt, and more important, seeking that city, the very kingdom of God. You see, because we also have a designer and builder, the very creator of the universe, who calls to you and to me, and he says, if you follow me, you will truly fare well.